The pre-K-12 Appropriation Subcommittee will come to order. Adrian, please call the roll.
Chair Fawn.
Here.
Vice Chair Bill.
Here.
Chair Fawn.
Still here.
Vice Chair Bill.
Here.
Representative Lupus.
Here.
Andrade.
Here.
Bartleman.
Here.
Bush.
Here.
Federhoff.
Here.
Haig.
Here.
McLean.
Here.
Roach.
Present.
Smith.
Here.
Trunau. Valdez.
Present.
Ranking Member Wilhite.
Here.
Representative Williams.
Here.
You have a quorum, sir.
All right. Members, welcome. Please make sure all of your electronic devices are turned off or are on vibrate. And I just wanted to offer something, at least in this committee. If any of you want to get a little bit more socially distant, particularly from me, I don't mind if people want to just go sit out in the audience. You can come back if you want to ask a question, just an offer. Some of the committee rooms, seemed pretty tight. So just an offer, if you want to go sit out there, I won't be offended, and, you know, it's not a problem. But welcome, everyone. I am very, very excited for us to be here working on the pre-K through 12 budget and issues related to that. Our meeting today is going to go through some overview of that budget and a presentation that I will give shortly. But before we begin, let me introduce our staff who will do much of the hard work that we end up seeing here, and I encourage all of you to get to know them. They're fantastic, and I've worked with Denise on and off for 4 years now since I sat on this committee as a first-year member. So Denise Potvin is our budget chief right over here. Ryan Bailey, where are you? Right over there is our budget analyst, and Adrian Young is our administrative assistant. Today we're doing a budget workshop. As I said, the presentation is going to give a high-level look at our subcommittee's jurisdiction, what our current budget looks like, and the challenges we face with next year's budget. Once I've completed the presentation, and I don't think it'll take 20 minutes, I do like to talk, as many of you know, but I will try to keep it short. We'll take a moment for introductions from members of the committee. Any of you who want can introduce yourself, tell us about your interest in serving on the subcommittee, anything that you want. And the last slide on the presentation will provide some points that we should consider as we begin our budget work. As part of your introduction, please comment and provide some discussion on the points that we raised in the presentation, if there's anything that you observe that you find interesting. But before we do that, Ranking Member Wilhite, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the honor of serving with you on this committee. I know myself and my colleagues know that this is one of the most important areas probably in the future of our state is our youth and making sure they have a good education and a basis for their future. So thank you, and I look forward to working with you on this and hopefully benefiting all the children of our state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great, and I'm looking forward. I'm very lucky to have you as my ranking member, and I mean that. Vice Chair Bell, anything you'd like to add?
I would also like to concur with Will Hite that it is an honor to serve on this committee. If we get education right, we get the world right, and so, you know, this is the future of our children and the future of our grandchildren. So I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
All right. Well, it is true. This is where our future began. Some of you may know I ran for the legislature because of the experiences that my son, who was then a first grader, had in public school. And I'm sure I will tell that story at some point. But this is an area of passion for me, and I'm very, very excited to be here to do this. So we have a presentation. I'm just going to go ahead and get started. You can follow along on the screens or on your computer. And again, I'll take questions at the end, and then any questions you have, and then we'll go around and folks can make comments. So what are our responsibilities as a committee? Well, we have five. So one is to produce a recommendation for the House's proposed budget and conforming and implementing legislation relating to pre-K through 12 education. In a number of weeks, I'll come in here based on the work that we have done, and I will present our proposed budget that will then likely be incorporated into the House's full budget. That's our primary responsibility. The second thing, and this is something that I have enjoyed the last 2 years chairing a different education appropriation subcommittee, is providing legislative oversight regarding the money that is spent. You know, we spend $92 billion here a year as a state, as we're going to find a lot of it on this, and making sure that money is spent effectively and appropriately is a very high responsibility, particularly now when, as we're going to see, we're kind of short on funds. Third, we will review the governor's budget recommendations and agency legislative budget requests. and I expect that we will do that at the next meeting that we have in 2 weeks. Fourth, we'll analyze the trust funds for creation, termination, or modification. You'll see as we go through the presentation, we have trust fund revenue. And then fifth, we will consider legislation with a fiscal impact. For the benefit of our new members, any bill that you file that has a fiscal impact, typically the second stop will be the appropriations subcommittee that deals with that area. So if you file a bill that, you know, required every kid to get a free scoop of ice cream at the end of every day, which I know my son Jacob would like, as with David, that would have a fiscal impact. The second stop for that bill would be here. So there will come a point where we will probably hear some legislation, although we're typically never the first stop for it. All right, so getting into the numbers. This is what I'm going to be presenting today is the budget that we approved last year. So for the members that were here when we left in March as COVID was beginning, we passed a budget, and I think it passed unanimously. And obviously the world changed quite a bit. It was actually changing, but we didn't know how much. And this is the budget that we presented. And what I wanted to point out is you can see on our total funds and our general revenue broken out by the varying appropriation silos. We are pre-K through 12, which you'll see is the orange. Does this have a little shooter? Oh, it does. Well, it does, but it's too far. All right. We are the orange slice of the pie, and we are 18% of total education spending, $17 billion. We're the second largest source of total funds, but along with education, with higher education, we make up 27% of total funds. But when it comes to general revenue, and these are the most flexible funds that we have in the budget, they're not trust funds, they're not federal funds. This is sort of the truly where we can spend it kind of wherever we want. K through 12 education is the largest budget silo, with $13 billion is K through 12 education. It's 38% of the budget. And when you add that and higher ed, our education system takes more than half of our general revenue. Moving on to the next slide. This just shows it again, the pre-K through 12 budget to our total state budget. Again, $17 billion, 18%. Everything else is 82%. And you can see our FEFP, which is where the bulk of the funding goes. This is the primary funding mechanism for our K through 12 education, makes up about 14% of the total budget, or $13 billion this year. Okay. So every appropriation silo is split into sort of sub silos. And in this area, if you ever really want to dig in to the budget, and I encourage you to do it, it's very educational. I did it as a first year freshman. I was only on the committee for one of the 2 years. I moved to a different appropriation silo for my second year. But I learned about it then, and now it's helpful to me now as I chair the committee. So we have six different budget entities, what I think of as sub silos. First is early learning. So this is education. This would fall into the pre-K part of pre-K through 12. This funds the Office of Early Learning, staff operating expenditures, our school readiness program, which is targeted, and we'll hear a lot, I'm sure, from Representative Alupis about this as we go through this, but this is education services we provide to kids even before they reach the age of four, and then VPK, which is a program that Florida has been a leader in that is available to all of our residents. So that's early learning. The next three all relate to K through 12. At the FEFP, again, that's that number I showed you before. This is the appropriations for the operational support of school districts, but we do not appropriate local school board revenues. And so one of the things I asked to put in here, we did this when we looked at higher education the last 2 years, is I want everyone to understand the true cost of educating our children, irrespective of the source of funding. If you say, well, here's what the state is spending on K through 12 education, we should also understand what the local governments are raising on education, and so are spending on education. And so we'll track that as we go through this presentation. K through 12 non-FEFP, this is additional K through 12 spending that supplements or enhances things in the FEFP, and this is generally where our member projects go. So if we have any member projects in this committee, and I'll talk about that later in the presentation, this would be where they would show up in our budget. Then there's federal grants. I think that's fairly obvious. This is, we do get a lot of federal money. We'll talk about that here. And this is where that money flows through to school districts. And then two things that aren't directly related to educating students remain in here. One, educational media and technology services. We have to be nice when we talk about this one, or they'll cut off the camera. This is what funds the Florida Channel, as well as provides funding for our public radio and public TV stations. It's not a huge part, as we're going to see. And then lastly, the State Board of Education, sort of the government bureaucracy that oversees everything. Those are our six areas. When we look in terms of where the money goes, and this is now a pie chart of our silo, the overwhelming is state grants, K through 12, FEFP, three quarters of the money. You can see state grants, non-FEFP, this is the member project part I mentioned, 3%. Federal grants, 11%. So obviously the federal part is 90%. I'm sorry, the K through 12 part. Early learning, 8%. The Board of Education, 2%, and then the Florida Channel and Public Broadcasting is 0.06%. So a very small amount relative to the budget. But again, I, at least for me, I take every dollar seriously. So the fact that your funding may be little doesn't mean it shouldn't be looked at relatively. So here is the pre-K through 12 budget five-year history. And again, this is all looking backwards. Excuse me. This is all based on what we passed. And what you will see, the chart shows the funding sources as well as the growth rate year to year. And what you'll see is going back 16-17, which would have been the year before I was in the legislature, you can see that we spent, you know, in the range of $23 billion on pre-K through 12, made up, you can see the GR at 11.5, trust funds at 3, local funds of 8.8. That line represents the growth rate year to year. And you can see every year, we've typically averaged about a 3% increase in spending. If you look at what we budgeted for last year and what it was 5 years earlier, general revenue's gone from 11.5 to 13.1, so 1.6 billion increase. Trust funds have gone from about 3 to 3.6 billion, so about 550 million increase. And then local funds have gone from 8.8 to 9.6, so a little less than $1 billion increase. And again, we don't appropriate the yellow, but I think it's important because that is money that gets spent on educating our kids. Whether a teacher's paid from local funds or state funds or electric bill is paid from that, it doesn't really matter. Those are the services that are provided to our children. All right. Now this slide basically makes one change to the last slide because I wanted to feature this because I wanted people to be aware because I think this is something that we will talk about in this committee in weeks ahead. As a result of COVID, there have been, and I'll have a slide dedicated to this later in the presentation, there have been two, whatever you want to call COVID packages. Everyone knows about the CARES Act. And then there was a second one that just passed in December. In addition to all the other money that those federal borrowings are paying for, one of them is for K through 12 education. And so this little blue thing that you see at the top is CARES money that we weren't expecting to get when we passed the budget that have come in. And it, while it is not a huge amount overall, when you look at it that way, it's $900 million of additional money into our school system. And that actually took our education spending all the way up to a 7% increase year over year. So it's been when you add in the CARES funds, it's been a huge increase in the amount of money that has been spent on education. And by the way, as you'll see later, it will be even more dramatic when we look at the second amount of federal funding, which I'll share later. This is our five-year history of students. We call them FTEs. That's not employees. For those of you who come from the business world, FTE is full-time equivalent students, and how many students have been in the system. And what you can see is it's increased based on what we projected. 5 years ago, it was just north of 2.8 million students, and that's gone up over 5 years to a projection of about 2.9 million students. So about 100,000 students over that period of time. We've had growth every year. But one of the things that we will be focusing in on this committee, and I want everyone, this is one of the most important things I hope you take away from this presentation, is projections often do not meet reality. This is what we thought would happen. It's not what happened. Somehow, because of COVID, we've had somewhere in the range of 90,000 students disappear. They are no longer recorded as our FTEs. So actually, if you look at what our FTE count is right now, it's approximating what it was 5 years ago, a precipitous decline. Well, why is that? Well, COVID happened, and we don't know all the answers, but we're going to be looking into this as a committee. What happened to these 90,000 students? Where'd they go? Well, they could have gone, as I can only come up with three explanations, and we're going to be digging into this in future meetings. One of them is some parents may have said, because of COVID, I'm just going to put my kid in home. I'm just going to homeschool my child. Now, they should have turned in a form to the school district saying they were doing that, but they may have decided, I don't want to deal with this, I'll homeschool them. Another group may have said, look, I don't like how the public schools, the government schools are operating. I'm going to put my child in private school. And they may not have turned in the form. And so that could explain some of the huge number of students who have disappeared. But there's a third category, which frankly may be an existential threat to the state of Florida, which is no school. And I don't know what the number is, and we don't know today, but some of these 90,000 children are not going to school at all. And that creates life-changing, life-altering consequences, and it's a big deal. 90,000 students would make, if that was a school system, would be about one of the 10 largest school districts in the state. So imagine one of our 10 largest school districts in the state just shut. And that's what's happened in the state of Florida. Part of the reason for this is we funded our school systems. We held them harmless. And we said, we will give you the funding, not based, we made a fundamental change in how, and we didn't make it, but it was done in an executive order. We made a fundamental change in how we fund education. We said, no longer is funding going to be based on student enrollment. It's going to be based on projected student enrollment. So the schools, so everyone understands, are getting the funding for these 90,000 students that do not exist and are not attending. So there's clearly a fiscal impact. But the bigger impact, and the one that keeps me up at night, is the notion that there is some number between 0 and 80,000, and I suspect it's a very large percentage of it, of children who are literally not going to school at all. So that's something that we're going to be digging into in this committee in a big way, and I hope if you take anything away from this presentation, it is that. Okay, our appropriated FEFP funding, 5-year history, including local revenues. Again, this shows you what we have been spending in education, whether it came from the state or whether it came from the local governments. And you'll see consistent increases, 2%, 2.4, 2.4, 2.2, 3.5, 3%. So we have materially increased our education spending every year, at least that I have been in the legislature. And, you know, and that doesn't even include here the CARES Act money that I mentioned before. All right, so that's the past, or at least the past and what we thought this year would look like. What does the future look like? And so those of you who sat on the full Appropriations Committee may have seen some of these slides that I've shown before, and I will show. But what is the past is great. But now what are we going to do for this year? So what's our first look at next year's budget? There's a whole process for how the budget works, but part of it is creating a long-range financial outlook, and it's issued by the Legislative Budget Commission. That's a group of people that meets in between our sessions. And on September 10th, they issued this long-range outlook, kind of right in the midst of the damage of COVID. And I say damage, I mean, I always tell people COVID is not only a health crisis, but it's a fiscal crisis, it's an education crisis, it's an everything crisis, because it's affected every aspect of our lives. But this outlook looks at revenue and expenditure estimates over 3 years. So they predicted what these next three budget years. So last September, they said, what's our budget going to look like starting July 1st of this year and then for the next 3 years? A whole lot of smart people get together. That's my layman's term for what estimating conferences are. A bunch of smart people get together and they sort of figure out in good conscience what they think. They make predictions of what the future is going to look like. And they also look at expenditures for critical needs, other high priority needs, and revenue adjustments that need to be made. And then once they're done with this long-range outlook, they say, hey, we're either going to have a lot of money we didn't expect, or oh gosh, we are, if things remain as they have been, we are going to have a deficit. And that is the focus. So what did the results of that exercise show? Well, it was pretty grim. So the exercise, and this is a nonpartisan exercise, this is economic experts just predicting the future, said that, you know, we are going to have a deficit for the year that begins in July, for the budget year that we are working on, of $2.75 billion. So we have to cut $2.75 billion of spending that we've expected to spend in order to balance our budget, which fortunately is something I'm happy about. Unlike Washington, we here in the Florida legislature are required to balance our budget. So we must bring it into balance. We just can't go borrow money from our kids. We have to balance it. By the way, this number, just so everyone understands, and correct me if I'm wrong, Denise, but I don't think I am, this assumes $0 for non-recurring spending, no member projects. So if you have a great idea and you want to do something at a school in your area that's going to cost $10 million, well, then the deficit would be $2.76 billion. So this assumes zero, and not only, to be clear, not only zero new member projects, this assumes zero of last year's member projects, because member projects, as many of you know, are non-recurring spending. So it assumes anything you brought home to your district or you got done doesn't happen. $2.75 billion is the prediction for this year, $1.9 for our second year of this session, of this term, and then a little under $1 billion for the third year. And they reforecast this every so often, and maybe this will get better, but what I think everyone believes is the deficit's not going to go away. It might go down a little bit. So the next slide is, you know, the cool thing when you have this job is you get to work on the budget as the largest amount of general revenue, which means it's the budget with the largest amount of flexibility. The bad news is when it comes time for budget cuts, if you are asked to absorb your pro rata amount, it also is the biggest amount. So if we were asked to provide our pro rata portion of necessary budget cuts for next budget year, and again, assuming zero member projects, this silo would have to come up with over $1 billion in cuts to our pre-K through 12 budget in those six silos, which is really, by the way, only kind of two. It's early learning and K through 12. The other two are rounding errors in the grand scheme of things. So to get that billion, if we had to do that, there would be meaningful cuts to either early learning or K through 12 or both. That doesn't mean we're going to be asked to do that. This is just if it was prorated. All right, so a slide about federal money. And we are going to dig into this in more detail in future meetings, because I think it's important. I take a holistic view of spending, as I did in higher education. I don't care where the money comes from. It's what are we doing with it? And the federal government, through these two relief bills, one earlier in the year, one in December, has allocated a huge amount of money to our K through 12 system. Again, keep in mind, they're already getting money for 80 some odd thousand students who aren't attending. In addition to that, our school districts received in the CARES Act $693 million of funding, of which, when we track this, and again, we'll deal with it, we're going to give a detailed presentation in a couple weeks, they have spent thus far $235 million of it. So there's still plenty that they have not spent. The deadline of giving the funds out is actually only in a few months. And what could they use this money on? Well, anything related to preventing, preparing for, or responding to COVID. You bought all those computers because you had kids at home. You know, you had to clean up better. I mean, there's a lot of things that our schools are doing. And this, so you can't say, you know, gosh, I want to buy more books for the library. But you know, anything, it's a pretty broad definition. And the funds will be available through September of next year. And then there was a second round in December of $2.8 billion. of which none has been given out. So we hadn't even spent half of the first amount of, and by the way, let me be clear, this is borrowed money from our children and grandchildren. We hadn't spent the first amount, and Washington decided to send down another $2.8 billion for more, again, preventing, preparing, and responding to COVID. So there are broad, and we're going to hear the sorts of things that our school districts are spending this money on in the future. But I think this is important because this is a material amount of money, and it does change our outlook on the budget. It's a lot. And by the way, if we were to continue to spend what we've always spent on education, plus all of this money, it'd be kind of a boon year for K through 12 education. And I think my personal view is COVID funds should make you whole. They shouldn't kind of be allowed to, you know, be like a payday, if you will, for a budget area. Okay, lastly, where do we go from here? And then I'll answer questions, and then we can, you know, anybody can share thoughts and introduce themselves, and then we will wrap up. So as we think about what we're going to spend money on, what are the criteria we should use to determine the highest and best use of state resources? Well, how do we determine if a program is valid? You know, there are lots of things that we spend money on as a state that have never really been looked at. And one of the things I was proud to do over the last 2 years in higher ed is we looked at everything. And we said, gosh, this might have made sense 40 years ago, but maybe it doesn't today. Is the spending core to the legal mandate that we're trying to do? Is this really a core function of government? Is the spending critical? Is it a must-do or a nice-to-do? Obviously, there's certain things that we have to do, and there's certain things that we don't. Is it required under the Constitution or federal law or a state match? Is it something we have to do, or we'd be really dumb not to, you know, like where there's a lot of matching funds if we're doing the right thing? And then again, and this is code for being efficient, how can we reprioritize funding? Because we may need to do that. So with that said, that is the end of the presentation. I'll just go ahead and leave it on this slide just for this is the grim slide. Just for everyone's benefit, as people ask me questions. But with that, I am happy to answer any questions that folks have. Vice Chair Bell, you're recognized.
Thank you, and thank you for that presentation. I think you did an awesome job of putting it into layman's terms for us, so I appreciate it. I'm very concerned about the 90,000 students that are unaccounted for, and I understand that there is each school has a truancy officer. Can the CARES Act money be used to maybe fund more truancy officers to find these children? Because as we know, these kids are at home, a lot of mental illness, a lot of physical and sexually abused children that's going on right now. So are we able to say, okay, we're going to give funding, but we want you to hire a truancy officer for each school and go out and find these children? I don't think it's so important.
We can look into that. And like I said, we're going to do a whole meeting about this where we talk about it. And by the way, I would encourage you, I think we have it. I think we have, if you want to know how many kids are missing in your school district, we have that. You reach out to staff and they can tell you, and it'll be the most depressing thing you hear all week. But yeah, I mean, we have to do that because I believe that not sending I have a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old. If I was not sending my 12-year-old to school, remember there's a e-learning option.
Yes.
You know, there's a Florida virtual school option. If I'm not putting my child in school, I think that's child abuse.
Oh, I do.
And so I think that's something we probably would, no one in this room, Republican or Democrat, would disagree with. So that is going to be absolutely something that we tackle.
Thank you.
Representative Bartleman, you're recognized for a question.
Yes, that was a great presentation. Thank you very much. I know in my school district, we are sending social workers door to door.
It's okay. Just talking. I'll look at the back of your head. It's okay. It's more important that your mom and dad watching at home on the Florida channel see you ask this question.
Okay, enjoy my calic then. So I know in my school district, we're sending out social workers to all the homes. So I know some school districts are being proactive. I have a question about the COVID dollars, the December appropriation. Is there language about supplanting?
Oh, so your question, I think, see if I could restate it. If I had put money in the budget to buy 1,000 computers,
correct,
and now I could use that money for that, yes, we could supplant that money. It does not have to be incremental.
So we can use it to fill the hole.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Ranking Member Wilhite, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know if this is where you wanted to introduce just questions or...
Let's do any questions folks have
okay.
about the presentation, and then you'll go first.
No, I don't need to go first, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. But so on page 7, I was noticing in your presentation, we talk about how the the money moves and how much we appropriate. But is that at all compared to population? Because I don't see exactly where it shows population into that to be in comparison. Page 8, I think, went more into population. But my question then is why in year 17 and 18 did we have such a large spike in funding for K-12 education and it come back down if our population has and continued to grow?
Well, I'm going to actually ask my staff to help me answer that question. But what I would do is if you compare slide 7, which is what we spent, to slide 9, which is the number of kids that we have, you'll see in each year, so I'll just go through them. In 16-17, we had less than 1% more students. We spent 2.5% more money. In 17-18, we had 0.6% more students. We spent 4.2% more money, which is the question we're going to answer in a minute.
Okay.
In 2018-19, we had 0.33% more students, 2.5% more spending. 19-20, 1% more students, 2.5% more spending. And 2021 was 1% more students, 3.4% more spending. So you can see in each year we have spent dramatically more. The increase has been dramatically more than just the number of students. Now, as to why 17 and 18 was so much greater, I don't know the answer to that. We can, do you know? Okay, so the belief is, and we'll research and get back to you, that we may have moved a source of funding that was not in the FEFP calculation into the FEFP calculation. So something that was being spent, the Best and Brightest program, that was being spent outside FEFP, was moved into FEFP. But we'll get the answer. I'll get it to you. I'm not sure it was 4 years ago. So, yeah.
Just follow up there, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, follow
up. So I would assume that that it would associate the same amount still then. So that's what seems, if you moved it that year, was it a one-time year, or why wouldn't it be recurring that it would stay that high still then? What I mean?
I
doubt we did a one-time year allocation and then took it all back.
It would, but it would only show up as an increase the first time you did it.
Okay.
Then it's built into the base. But I don't know the answer, but I'll figure it out. We'll figure it out and get it to you.
Thank you, Mr.
question.
Chairman.
And these are the kind of great questions people should know, because when you've got when the future is going to be different than the past, you need to understand why the past is what it was. Yes, Representative Hague, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair Fine. The 90,000 students that have disappeared, for lack of a better word, in looking, when those analysts did that deficit number of the $2.7 billion, did they account for the $90,000 of money that's being appropriated to the school, the 90,000 students that have dollar allocations going to those schools? You see what I'm saying? There's money that's going into the schools that account for the 90,000 students. And okay.
Right. Okay. So the answer is the yes, because at that point the students hadn't disappeared. So yeah, that assumes all of the students. And by the way, there is, and this is getting into the technical details, there is a ongoing discussion right now as people put together forecasts of what should the student enrollment projection be for next year. There are some who are advocating that we assume that just magically these 90,000 kids just come back, you know, for whatever reason. And then there are others, and I'm one of them, who's like, well, why should we just assume they magically come back? But yeah, that long-range forecast did not account for all this because we didn't know all the kids would be gone when it was done.
Right. So, but my question is this. It accounted for the revenue through the FEFP that goes to the school for the 90,000 students. So it accounted for the revenue there. My question is, when they came to the deficit number, they didn't pull that money back and shorten the deficit by that amount of money?
No. They did not assume when they –
That's my question.
Long-range number. It's a great question. That long-range number assumes that those 90,000 kids
are there,
are going to school, or we continue to do what we did this year and give school districts the money for those kids even if the kids aren't attending, because that's what we're doing right now. We did not, the school districts are, they are getting the money for those 90,000 kids. They're not educating them. And again, I'm not, there's, we don't know why. I'm not trying, there's, you know, if we want to assess blame, there's probably plenty of it to go around, but all we know is 90,000 kids aren't in school at all that we're supposed to be.
Right. And well, should have been. Just one last follow-up. Yep. So my right. Point would be, whatever that dollar amount equals for those $90,000, those 90,000 kids, we just shortened our deficit by that much because they're counting for it. So there's that number should come off of that deficit number as we move forward. That's my point.
And that's an option that we're talking about, because certainly I come from the private sector. I believe in incentives, and if there's no incentive, when I removed my son from public school when he was in first grade, the principal said, "That's fine. We still get the money."
Wow.
He's not a principal anymore. but you know, if there's no incentive to find and return the kids, obviously, if you say, look, you have to have the kids in order to get the funding, there will be more incentive. Not to say some school districts aren't trying to find them already, but clearly the loss of funding. I also think it sets a dangerous precedent, because it means that we're no longer funding education based on student enrollment. We're funding it based on, like, other things. Are there other questions? Yes, Representative Lupus, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great presentation, sir. Two questions, if you'll permit me, but they'll be brief.
Sure.
The first on the 90,000 students, not to harp on it, I think it's a critical question. One of the things, and maybe we don't have the answer yet, but we saw a significant decrease in the enrollment in pre-K this year in VPK. I wonder if I'm not assuming all 90,000 are kindergarten students, because the cohort's probably 220, 225,000. I wonder what percentage of those 90,000 are parents who had kindergarten age children who just said, we're going to hold off and have our children. So something to look at and think about, because I have had school districts tell me they've seen drops in their kindergarten enrollment. Second question is, and I've seen it obviously.
Can I answer that first?
Yeah, of course.
That's a great point, because and that we should be able to figure out. We have that? Okay.
It is kindergarten?
Yep. The largest population is kindergarten students.
Do we know the percentage of the full 90,000?
Do you know what it is? Do we know it? We think it's about 20%.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you, Denise.
And that's a good explanation. It means those kids actually, one would assume, would come back, you know,
yep.
Assuming the world is somewhat back to normal by the fall. That's a great point.
And then the second question, because I've seen this in the early learning space. So we talked about the CARES Act money coming down. Are we going to is the sense that we're going to have great coordination with the agencies to understand how they're using the money? Because there has been questions in the early learning space about how quickly the money is moving into you know, the centers. And I think it's an essential piece for the challenges that we have, you know, putting together a budget, knowing that literally hundreds of millions of additional dollars are going to be coming in. So just wanted to ask if they're going to be constantly updating us with how those dollars are being distributed.
So we are getting updated right now, but I will take from you, and if you want to work with us on this, to make sure as we're looking at that, we keep a focus on early learning. You know, I'll task you with that, because one of the opportunities and challenges is I dealt with this in higher ed, that the you focus on the huge pots. You don't necessarily focus on the smaller pots. Mm-hmm. It's still hundreds of millions of dollars, but it's not the huge pot. So I'm going to count on you to make sure that we stay focused on that early learning.
I'm there for you, Chairman.
All right. Other questions? Yes. Representative Bartleman, you're recognized again.
I apologize.
That's okay. And we have 21 more minutes.
I just thought this was important for me to find out. Right now, we're virtual FTE. We're funding as in-person FTE for our school districts. And there's still children that are going to have pre-existing.
We can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. Right now, we're holding school districts harmless as it pertains to virtual FTE. We're funding them as in-person FTE. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that children with pre-existing conditions are still going to need to access virtual education through the school system. So are we, as part of our budget decisions, are we still going to make schools whole on that FTE?
So that is one of the fundamental questions that should you pay a school district for students that aren't attending? If we do that, you know, we set a precedent. We fundamentally transform how education works in Florida from being focused based on student enrollment to whatever we feel like. Because one of the things we're going to find, and we're going to look at this, is that not all school districts have lost the same percentage of students. I don't know why. but not all of them have lost the same. So if you no longer, if you're holding harmless, the ones who have for however reason kept the largest percentage of their students, they're getting the shaft versus the ones who have lost a ton of students who are getting all of this money, they're not educating students. That's why we focus on per student funding. And these are the issues we're going to have to get into. And that's why I highlighted it so much. But I think what we have to keep in mind is, you know, 80, 90,000 kids, many of whom not going to school. That's the number one thing that is, you know, that is concerning. But these are going to be the discussions that we have. And I said, we're going to have a whole panel, I think, a whole meeting just talking about these kids that are missing. Yep. Any other questions? This side of the room wasn't all that curious. Okay, so I'm done. What I'd like to do, we have a few minutes left. So again, some of our committees have had time to do this, some haven't, but just to go around the room, I'm not gonna recognize each person individually. I'm just gonna ask us to start with Ranking Member Wilhite and introduce yourself and, you know, who you are, your district, and your interest in being on this committee, you know, if you have that interest. Sometimes we get assigned to committees that we didn't ask to be on, and that has happened to me once or twice. So that's okay, and that means you get to learn something that you didn't expect to. I do expect that our former school board members wanted to be on this committee, but some of the others, you know, may not have. So, Ranking Member Wilhite, if you just want to take a minute and introduce yourself, and we'll just go that way and around the room. And I'm not going to recognize each person. Well, just go in order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you know, my first term, I served on an education committee. My second, I didn't. And although I enjoyed it my first term, I did miss it last term. I represent the 86th District, which is in Central Palm Beach County. We have the 10th largest school district in the United States. We're a pretty big district, obviously. I guess my biggest interest in being on any education committee is I have a 12 and 13-year-old sons that are in public schools right now. And they're learning from home. Since last March, they've been learning from home. And although they're still getting education, they're still working on it, they're learning new things in some aspects. But as a family, we're learning different things too, because now I'm not just the parent, I'm the school lunch person, I'm the truant officer, I'm the school police officer, I'm everything here at this. So
I feel bad for them.
Yeah, so it's very difficult. But you know, again, as I said in my opening comments, this is probably the single most important thing, I think, in our future. And just a couple of comments, if you don't mind. You know, when we talk about this budget and the shortfall, this doesn't account, obviously, any projected, and we're not even sure what our revenue could get from the federal government if more money was to come down at the shortfall. It's only about 3% of our budget. And so we say only 3%, yes, $2.7 billion. But, you know, as you and I have been here for the last 4 years, we've put a lot of money for rainy days. And this is maybe where that rainy day is a little bit. We've been very fiscally responsible in our budgets and reserves and stuff. So maybe that's an area we can look at. But I can tell you through all this, you know, my school district has still collected $72 million a year right now in sales tax that we have in addition, a five-year sales tax that our schools that our voters voted for. You know, and they've had to buy 80,000 more computers and get Wi-Fi to kids in rural areas and different things. So it's been a very challenging year for them. So I think when we say either the kids are learning from home or these different things, it's still very expensive to the school district because they've had to put a lot of challenges in place, whether it's more testing or more filters and more computers and all that. So I think when we talk about this, we have to recognize their work that they've done as well, too. And so I know this is a very passionate issue for a lot, as myself, and I know you, and I've heard you speak about your kids so much and how important they are. So I appreciate the opportunity to serve on this. And I think that with your diligence and yearn for knowledge, we will find out some of the answers to where these kids went and what's happening. So I appreciate the opportunity to serve. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to serve with you. And I know the great dialogue we've already had and we will continue to have throughout this process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vance Lupus, House District 115 in Miami-Dade County. I serve as the chair of the Early Learning and Elementary Education Subcommittee. I've worked in early childhood education for more than a decade, and to be honest, I cannot think of an appropriations committee I would prefer to be on. I've worked alongside Chair Fine the last 2 years, an incredible friend, but I think the issues we're going to be talking about this year are central to the future of our state.
My name is Brett Haig. I am District 33, which is Sumter County, a portion of Lake County, and a portion of Marion County. I don't have any children in the public schools. I have a senior in college at a private university. But I'm passionate about this because of my business background and the challenge and then the cause, right? So we've got the massive challenge with this budget and numbers and still trying to be good stewards, but, you know, we're talking about children here. So I really look forward to it. I served on the same committee last year. I was just allotted to the committee, just as you said, Chair Fine. But I learned so much. I'm really grateful to be on it with some of you warriors in the world of education. So I look forward to it.
Yeah, Keith Trunell, District 31. I'm honored to be on this committee. I think education is core to the success and the future of all the citizens of Florida. I look forward to learning all I can and being a helpful hand in any way that I can be possible. Thank you very much.
Me. Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm State Representative James Bush III. I represent the 109th District in Miami, Florida. And I'm honored to be on this committee with you, Mr. Chairman, one of the finest chairmen in the country. And my interest here is that I like to make sure that we provide a quality education for every child in the state of Florida. With that being said, I'm looking forward to working with you. And you asked me what did I want. I still need a blessing, and I do have my list. I still have my list over here. And if you need me to pass the list to you right now, I can give you that before I leave. Thank you, sir.
To all you freshman members, this is how you get the odds of your project being funded increased. So I'm kidding. Go ahead. Representative Bush is a great friend and a great member.
Thank you, Chair. Representative David Smith from East Seminole County. A pleasure to be on the committee, especially with Chair Fine's leadership. This was a committee I worked to get on because I think we all know the challenge that we'll face as a state, and we've already talked about the what's at stake if we get this wrong. So, you know, we want to face the challenge, we want to face it head on, and I'm happy to be here and roll up the sleeves and get to work. Thank you, Chair.
Good afternoon, everyone, and I am Representative Susan Valdez, proudly representing District 62 in the Tampa Bay area, and go Bucks. Chair Fine, it's a pleasure to be with you in this silo to discuss the appropriations process for our K-12 students. And just a quick reminder that Article 9 of the Constitution, of our Constitution, states that the education of children is a fundamental value of the people of the state of Florida. It is therefore a paramount duty of the state to make adequate provisions for the education of all children residing within its borders. Along with this constitutional duty, I'd like to focus the discussion on budget through the lens of equity. And because it's important. A lot of us define equity in different ways. And I believe that when we look at anything through the lens of equity, we will wind up having a much better product for all that are involved. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Robin Bartleman, and I am a proud product of the Miami-Dade County Public School System. I'm the first one in my family to attend college and graduate because of great public school teachers in Miami-Dade County, including retired school teachers who gave me a scholarship. I was a special education teacher teaching students with severe emotional disabilities, an assistant principal down in Liberty City, and for the last 16 years, I've been the countywide school board member in Broward County. I think the most important job we have as a state is to educate our students, and so this was my dream to be on this committee. So I'm very excited to be here, and I'm very excited to serve with all of you.
I'm Patricia Williams from District 92. As a foster parent, I served as a role as a truant officer at all times, because we know foster kids have a tough time, so I'm constantly being a truant officer. So I guess that's what my role is going to be on this time. This is my third year, my third session serving on the committee, and I appreciate the opportunity. So I guess someone assumed that I like education because I played a role as a truant officer for foster kids. My voice is for the foster kids, the kids that's not here, that don't have the option, opportunity for someone to speak up for them. So I guess they feel, Mr. Chair, I have a big mouth for kids, so that's why they put me here.
I'm Stan McLean. I'm House District 23, which is Marion County, and this is my fifth year being on the pre-K-12 appropriation subcommittee. So I'm going to designate myself as the senior ranking member, and you can just call me ranking member, all of you would be fine. And I'm excited to be here. It was much easier being on this over the last several years when there was plenty of revenue coming in, so it's going to be exciting to see what this is like. Reminds me of 2006 when I was a county commissioner, and the economy went south back then, and it was pretty ugly. And so we've got some work cut out. Chairman, I know that you've dealt with these issues before, so it'll be I'm pleased to be here under your leadership.
Good afternoon. My name is Alex Andrade. I'm the state representative for Florida House District 2, all the way in the great northwest in the central time zone in Pensacola, Florida. I'm excited this is my first year on this committee. But many of y'all might not know that even before COVID, my community already suffered from higher dropout rates in middle school than the rest of the state, higher rates of self-harm, mental health issues, food issues. And, you know, I'm just proud to represent a community that had already assessed that and voted this past general election to tax themselves in the most conservative area of the state, half millage just to start a Children's Trust, to start focusing on those issues and take control of it. So I'm excited to be participating in this conversation going forward this year.
Hi, State Representative Spencer Roach. I represent Eastern and Northern Lee County. There are 412 cities in the state of Florida, and I have the distinction of representing none of them. That's because I represent one of only two districts in the entire state that's all unincorporated. I did ask for this committee, and I'm grateful to Speaker Sprouls and Chair Fine for allowing me to serve on it. I do have an interest in children, and I think what I would ask for out of Chair Fine and this committee and what I hope to work on is not just ensuring that we are adequately funding education, but ways to empirically measure the data to make sure we know what that money is in fact buying and what results it's producing to ensure that we are investing in Florida's most precious natural resource, which are our children. That's it. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Representative Federhoff. I represent part of Volusia County, District 26. I am excited to be on this committee, believe it or not, even though it's appropriations. I think one of the most important things that we need to look at is not only funding education properly, but also, I can tell you, we've had our own issues in Volusia County as far as funds not going where they need to go. And I really think that we need to take a look at all 67 school districts and find a way to make them more accountable and more transparent. I agree that they need to have home rule. Don't want to take that away from them. But I think that our parents and our children and our taxpayers need to know where that funding is going. I've spoken with Chair Lavelle about this issue and would love to speak with you, Chair, as well, about what we can do to really make them more transparent. I've literally gone through all 67 budgets at one point when I worked with Senator Ugel's office, and it's like reading mud. And I think that if we really want to know that the money is going to what it needs to be going to, I mean, we had this issue with the teachers, making sure that they got raises. We had to literally earmark that. When we've been putting more and more money into education every year, and we had to set aside specifically money to make sure that our teachers were paid appropriately, that's unacceptable in my book. I want to see us do a better job of making sure those dollars are going where they need to go to, because our children are our future, and we need to make sure that they're being taken care of. So I appreciate being on this committee, and thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Excited to be here as again. I have two daughters that is a product of our public school system. Both of them went through University of Florida and are productive citizens. And now I have two granddaughters that will also be entering into public schools. I have been involved since my children have been small in the school system. I've served on the SAC committee, Student Advisory Committee, which I think needs to be revamped. I spoke with staff yesterday about this. It's more of a dog and pony show. I think, you know, we need more businesses and community leaders involved in the schools. I believe what Chair Fine said, you know, I come from the private sector, and we need more accountability. And I think if we got more private sector involved in our school system, it would have a lot more accountability for that. And also, I'm a true believer in career academies. I have served on the executive board for Polk County, on their academy board, through wall to wall, and not every child is going to college. And so to get them excited in the fifth, sixth, seventh grade of why they need to do English or math to be a plumber or electrician, and there's a connectivity. So I'm a true believer in that, but I should have said my name in my district, but Representative Melanie Bell, and I serve, represent District 56. Just going to take this off for a minute. And my counties are Polk, Hardy, and DeSoto County, which is very rural counties. So I appreciate being here and look forward to working with you.
All right, well, I didn't really tell anything about me. I'm Randy Fine. I represent Southern Brevard County. So for those of you who aren't experts in Florida geography, it's where the Kennedy Space Center is, although that's not in my district. I am the son of two public educators. So my mom was a public school, middle school science teacher. My dad was a public school university professor. So I got an earful from my father for the last 2 years. I'll get an earful from my mother for the next two. I am the father of two boys, and so I experienced the whole gamut of education. My youngest is in third grade in private school. My oldest is in seventh grade in public school, but he's taking half of his classes this semester from Florida virtual school. So I've got that experience as well. And as we all will, we will look at a lot of this through the lens of our children. So I'm excited to be here because my life has been pretty good, and the only reason for it is because I got a great public education when I was a kid. My family didn't have a lot of money. I made the most of my education, and it turned out great for me, and I want that for every child in Florida. I want to thank Speaker Sprouse and Chair Trumbull for giving me this opportunity. I'm very excited, and I asked for it, and they gave it to me, and I'm grateful for that. And I want to make clear to all of you that this is a journey that we go on together. My door is open. I think the Speaker is genuine when he says he wants members to be successful and have a good experience here, and I want to build on that. So if you don't have my cell phone number, you can get it. You can call me anytime, and I'm happy to work with you. Doesn't mean we're always going to agree on everything, but it always means I will at least, you'll always get to argue with me about it at least. So I want everybody to be successful. I will have an open door. So moving forward, we are going to have meetings digging into all of the things that we talked about here. We will not meet next week, but we will meet the week after on this every other week schedule. And feel free to let us know if there are things that you want to work on. Feel free to reach out to staff. But I think this is a great first meeting. We have concluded all of our business, and with no further business, Representative Bush moves we rise.